Chapter 1. Black Hand in Sarajevo. The 28th of June, 1914, was a warm and sunny day all across Europe. Few could have suspected that this outwardly tranquil summer day would be written in blood on the calendar of history, and that this fateful June day would be the precursor of so many blood-red June days for Europe in this century, from the conclusion of the Treaty of Versailles in June 1919 to the surrender of France in 1940 to the D-Day landings of 1944 to the dismantling of the old European order at Potsdam in June 1945. Nowhere on that fateful day did the sun's rays beat down more implacably than at Sarajevo, a sleepy Balkan town in Bosnia. The former seat of a province of the Ottoman Empire, it was oriental in appearance, with white minaret mosques towering over the winding streets of the bazaar. Administered by the Austro-Hungarian Empire since 1878, annexed outright in 1908, it was a place where little out of the ordinary ever took place. On this day, however, the most important man in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was visiting. He was the heir to the Habsburg throne on which the ancient Franz Joseph sat, who, at 86, after 66 years of rule, had been drained by illness and care. The Archduke was a robust man, his breast jingling with medals, his helmet richly plumed, an ardent hunter who had filled the palaces and hunting lodges of Europe with his antler trophies. The heir had come to Sarajevo in his capacity as commander-in-chief of the Austro-Hungarian army, to observe maneuvers which were being carried out several miles away. Franz Ferdinand and his consort, Sophie, rode along the quay beside Sarajevo's Miljak River virtually unprotected on their way to the town hall. Their four-car procession was barely underway when a young terrorist aimed a bomb at the Archduke. The bomb glanced off the back of the Archduke's car and exploded beneath the following vehicle, injuring two officers, one of whom was rushed to a nearby hospital. Franz Ferdinand and his wife, shaken but unhurt, continued on to the town hall, where the Archduke angrily rebuked the mayor for his city's lack of hospitality. Then the little motorcade set off for the hospital in which the wounded young officer was being treated. The lead car, in which the mayor sat, made a wrong turn, and the Archduke's car followed it. The military governor of Bosnia, General Podiorek, alertly signaled the driver to back up and return to the planned route. As the driver braked, a young man stepped forth, took careful aim, and fired two shots into the open car. One shot struck Franz Ferdinand in the neck. The other hit his wife Sophie, the Duchess of Hohenberg, in the stomach. As she slumped against her husband, his green tunic covered with blood, he murmured, "Sophie, live for our children." The couple died within minutes after the attack. The news of his nephew and heir's assassination was received by Emperor Franz Joseph at his palace in Vienna, the Hofburg, with unseemly coolness. The old man bore a grudge against Franz Ferdinand, perhaps partially because the Archduke had succeeded Franz Joseph's own son, Rudolf, who died in a tragic dual suicide with his lover, Marie Vetsera, in the Royal Hunting Lodge at Mayerling 25 years before. More important, Franz Ferdinand's wife Sophie, although a countess from an old Czech family, was far inferior in blood and rank to the standards prescribed by custom and law for a Habsburg empress. When Franz Ferdinand married her in 1900, he was forced to renounce all possibility of either his wife or their future children assuming the Habsburg throne. A morganatic marriage, unforgivable crime in the monarchical profession. To be sure, crowned heads are allowed mistresses and even bastards, perfectly permissible, amorous adventures. But if a Rudolf of Habsburg, a Franz Ferdinand, an Edward VIII of England, or a Leopold III, King of the Belgians, does not limit his choice to the princely game preserve of obligatory spouses, let him beware. So it was that at the state funeral for Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife in Vienna, the slain couple rode apart, in separate hearses, the Archduke's a majestic affair decked in black plumes and drawn with black horses, trailed by a procession of dignitaries of state and court, Sophie's following behind, notably less magnificent. At the cathedral her coffin was laid out one step below that of her husband. In lieu of a crown, the coffin of the Archduke's wife was decked by the fan of a mere court lady. The old man was still ashamed of his nephew's consort, even in death. Franz Joseph had another reason for not being overly perturbed at his heir's violent passing. The Archduke's political ideas and his notions for reforming the empire were anathema to the old monarch, who with each passing year grew ever more conservative. In 1867, Franz Joseph had been forced by circumstances, Austria's defeat by Prussia the year before, to grant the Hungarians an almost equal role in what became the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. In the following decades, the Slav subject to Habsburg rule had begun to clamor for increased recognition, and Franz Ferdinand was known to be sympathetic to them, perhaps even willing to go so far as to institute a trial or three-way monarchy. To the reactionary Franz Joseph, as well as to the proud Magyars, jealous of their prerogatives, trialism posed a grave threat to the empire. There were forces beyond the borders of the empire who found the Archduke's ideas threatening as well. Serbia, across the Danube from Austria-Hungary, was the most vigorous and aggressive of the Balkan countries. Subject to the rule of the Ottoman Turks for centuries, many of their people converts to Islam, the Balkan lands, Serbia, Bulgaria, Albania, Romania, and Greece had achieved their independence over the course of the 19th and early 20th century. Once free, they had devoted their energies to trying to dominate each other, squabbling over such inextricable intermingled ethnic and religious jumbles as Macedonia and Thrace with a barbarous zeal both murderous and indefatigable. Briefly united in 1912, the Balkan countries had succeeded in liberating the remainder of the Balkans from Turkish rule, driving the Turks back to the outskirts of Constantinople, the last Turkish outpost on European soil. The following year, the Serbs and Bulgarians had gone at one another with savage abandon, each determined to rule Macedonia. The hapless Macedonians themselves had borne the brunt of the struggle, thousands of them massacred, still more dragooned into the invading armies of the Serbs and Bulgarians. Serbia triumphed, for it had won the backing of a powerful patron, which was determined to use the small Balkan state as the fulcrum for its drive to the south and west the mighty Russian Empire. Defeated and humiliated by Japan in 1905, the Tsarist imperialists had been thwarted in their drive to the east. Gone were the days of the previous centuries, and the Cossacks swept invincibly across the crystalline snows of Siberia and the Great Bear advanced into Alaska and down the California coastline. The Russian Navy had been shown up as ponderously inefficient and outdated. After a bizarre adventure in the North Sea, in which Russian ships had fired on English fishing vessels in the belief that they were Japanese destroyers, the Russian fleet had sailed 10,000 miles only to be sent to the bottom by Admiral Togo's Japanese fleet at Tsushima Strait in May 1905. Russia's armies had been bested by the Japanese in Manchuria, with the resultant loss for the Tsar of Port Arthur and the remainder of Manchuria. Thereafter, the imperialists of the Russian Empire had changed their strategy, seeking to exploit the hopes and fears of their Slavic cousins in the Balkans, preeminently the Serbs and the Bulgarians, whose countries offered ready access to the Adriatic and that age-old objective of the Tsars, the multicolored domes and battlements of Constantinople, gateway to the warm waters of the Mediterranean. In 1908, still smarting from their Far Eastern disaster, the Russian imperialists and their Serbian protégés had been forced to accept, at the Congress of London, the annexation by Austria-Hungary of Bosnia-Herzegovina, a Slavic territory to the west of Serbia and long coveted by the Serbs. Serbian control of the region would have brought their Tsarist masters access to the ports of the Adriatic, but the Russians felt themselves too weak militarily to press the issue. Chastened but undiscouraged, the imperialist circle around Tsar Nicholas II, the Pan-Slavists, intensified its activity. Nicholas, dangerous precisely because of his weak will and his eternal vacillation, gave them free rein. The St. Petersburg regime stirred the already boiling Balkan cauldron ever more vigorously. Russian agents and Russian advisors gave the orders and supplied the wherewithal for the Serbs in their growing quarrel with Austria. As the Russian minister to Serbia, Nikolai Hartwig, indiscreetly remarked to the Romanian minister, Filoleidi, on November 12, 1912, Russia counts on making Serbia, enlarged by the Balkan provinces of Austria-Hungary, the vanguard of Pan-Slavism. Hartwig, the Tsar's ambassador, was the undisputed master of Belgrade, the man whom the French ambassador, Deskos, called the real sovereign of Serbia. Others referred to Hartwig merely as the viceroy. In theory, the head of state was Serbia's king, Peter I, but King Peter, the grandson of a hog dealer, owed his accession to the throne to a cabal of Serbian plotters who had assassinated the previous king, Alexander Obrenović, and his queen, Draga, in a grisly double murder in 1903. King Peter's family, the Karađorđeviches, had waged a running feud with their Obrenović rivals for most of the preceding century, in one incident of which the chief of the Obrenović clan had presented the carefully salted head of one of the Karađorđeviches to the Sultan in Istanbul. Peter I's prime minister, Nicholas Pašić, was a cunning and malleable man who had switched without undue fits of conscience from being Alexander's prime minister one day to heading the government of the king elevated by the assassins the next. He feared the firebrands who had murdered the royal couple. He was willing to serve as the tool of the powerful and influential Russians. The interrogation of Archduke Franz Ferdinand's assassins in Sarajevo led, slowly and inexorably, to the implication of the highest councils of the Serbian regime. At first tight-lipped, the two terrorists, Shabrinovic, who had tossed the bomb which missed the Archduke but wounded his officer, and Gavrilo Princip, who fired the fatal shots, denied any larger conspiracy. They let slip only one name. When asked who had taught them how to shoot, they replied, Saganovic. In fact, Milan Saganovic, an official of the Serbian Railway and member of the secret terrorist group, the Black Hand, was a personal agent of Prime Minister Pašić.